Well, see, usually I load up my map program while you guys are sharing something, so... Alrighty then, we'll dive into our lesson tonight. We are in the book of 2 Kings. We finished up 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, and 1 Kings. And so here we are in the last of these four historical narratives. And many of the things that Kings and Samuel record for us are fairly, I don't want to say ho-hum, but they're run-of-the-mill, they're average, they're normal life experiences. We have the lives of kings and the goings-on of nations and things like that. But occasionally, then, God records for us some of the amazing things that he accomplished, some of the things that sort of defy our understanding. It's the things that made the people in the 1920s start to question, now, come on, can that Bible really be real when it starts talking about things like fiery chariots and fiery horses? We think maybe that was just some illusion that Elijah saw and Elisha saw. But God recorded them as they happened, and we know that God doesn't lie. So even when he records crazy things like that, we say it must have happened that way, because our God can do those kinds of things. I just read a couple of articles by C.S. Lewis, and he's got a great take on miracles in the Bible. And of course, C.S. Lewis was alive and lived through the fundamentalist controversies of the 20s and 30s, right when all those things were going on that made people question the old-time religion, right? And many people were questioning whether miraculous things can happen and whether the Bible accurately records them, or because those people were, here's the air quotes, less advanced, less scientific than we are, they didn't understand, and so they just wrote them down and called them miracles, but they really weren't. C.S. Lewis' point was this. The very reason they wrote them down is because they recognized that they were miraculous things. These people understood what natural law was, otherwise it wouldn't have surprised them at all that Jesus walked on water. But why did that surprise them? Because they knew you shouldn't be able to do that. We know the normal functioning of God in this world means when things that are more dense than water hit the water, what happens to them? They sink. And while the human body is buoyant, it doesn't float on its feet on top of the water. It sinks down in a little ways. You know, we float right about here. Of course, you know, if you're made of muscle and everything, you sink right under. If you're like me, you sit a little higher up in the water depending on your density. We'll call it that, right? Or lack thereof. But even people in the first century, though they didn't have the technological advancements that we did, they understood what the normal functioning of the world was. And so they knew a miracle when they saw one, because they recognized that, look, bread does not normally multiply into enough bread to feed 5,000 people. That doesn't happen. A couple of little fishes, they can't feed that many people. So when they started writing those things down, it was precisely because they recognized this was out of the ordinary. This was miraculous. It wasn't that they were dumb. They were incredibly intelligent people. And so we come to a passage like 2 Kings chapter 2 and Chariots of Fire, and we're going to be reading some fantastical accounts. But we know that God records for us exactly what he did. He records it with astonishing detail. There was an article on the internet out of Israel that just this last week discovered another ancient city that confirms the historicity of the biblical accounts of David. Don't you love when that happens? Of course, you know what the article starts off with? Scholars are divided as to whether or not the Bible is an accurate recording of the life of King David. Which scholars are you talking to? Because the scholars I know aren't that divided on it. They're pretty certain this book is accurate history. David existed. And it was kind of funny, too, because they said, aside from some inscriptions about David and his house on tombs and Stella that we find lying around, we're not sure whether David was really a real person. So what they're saying is, here's the archaeological evidence. We find his name written on monuments all over the place. We have his name written in a very detailed history called the Old Testament historical books. And we find accurately the cities and things that are mentioned in the Bible. We find those exactly where the Bible describes them to be, but we're not sure he was real. So what evidence leads you to conclude that he's not real? Well, there isn't any, of course, except that they don't want to believe some of these fantastical things that happen in here. So we have been following since 1 Kings chapter 17 the life of this warrior poet, Elijah. He's quite a character. He presents himself in dramatic fashion in 1 Kings 17 by calling down a drought upon Israel that lasts for over 3 years. He ends that drought in dramatic fashion by calling fire down from heaven to consume the sacrifice upon the altar at Mount Carmel, and then kills 400 prophets of Baal. Some of the other times we see him were just back in chapter 1. He rebuked Ahaziah, the king of the northern kingdom of Israel, for Ahaziah's faithlessness. Ahaziah, if you remember, was injured. He fell from his roof. And he was sending to Baal, the god of Ekron, or Baal-zebul, to ask whether or not he would recover. And so Elijah again dramatically appears on the scene and says, "Is it because there's no God in Israel that you have to send to Ekron, the god of the Philistines, to ask for this?" Ahaziah doesn't like that answer, and so he sends 50 troops to try to apprehend, arrest Elijah, and bring him back to Samaria in chains. Elijah defends himself by calling down fire from heaven, consumes those 50 men. Well, Ahaziah doesn't give up easily. He sends another 50 troops. They are also burnt into charcoal. And it's the third group that finally wisens up and approaches Elijah humbly and petitions him to have mercy on the lives of his soldiers, which Elijah does. Elijah goes back, talks to Ahaziah, tells him, "You're going to die according to the word of the Lord," and so it happened. And that brings us to chapter 2. Well, for a man like Elijah, who appeared on the scene dramatically and entered every scene that we have recorded of him very dramatically, what else would be fitting except for an extremely dramatic departure from the scene? Exit, stage upward. This is going to be something spectacular. So we read in 2 Kings chapter 2, "Now, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind," and right off the bat, we're given this fantastical description of how Elijah's going to leave his ministry on this earth. God's going to take him to heaven in a whirlwind. Now, that doesn't mean that God is planning to kill Elijah with a tornado. I used to be terrified of tornadoes when I was a kid. I used to have nightmares about them every spring, about tornadoes coming in. The movie The Wizard of Oz terrified me. And it wasn't the flying monkey things later in the movie. It was that first scene where that twister's whipping through the land. Hated that part. Well, God is not saying, "I'm going to kill Elijah with a whirlwind" here. He's acknowledging something dramatic, something spectacular is going to happen here with Elijah. "I'm going to take him up to heaven." So who else in the entirety of the biblical narrative gets to go to heaven without dying? Moses died. Yeah, Moses actually, God took him apart by himself, but he died and was buried there. But there is one other, Enoch. Enoch, way back before the flood. And what are we told about Enoch? He walked with God and he was not, because God took him. That is a stark contrast from all the other descriptions in those genealogical lists, because how does every other one of those items in the genealogical lists end? "And he died." He lived X number of years and he died. But something different, something weird, something strange happens. We know that it is normal in this life, in this world, I should say. It's appointed unto men once to die, and after this to judgment. But God, in his own purposes, for his own reasons that he doesn't explain to us. Don't you love when God does that? He didn't check with me on why he's going to do this stuff, and that's okay. He didn't explain to me why it is Enoch and Elijah get to depart out of this world without death. But wait, there's more. It sounds like one of those TV infomercials, doesn't it? You know, hang on, you just get this second thing, just pay extra money. You know, it used to be when you called up on those commercials, they would say, "But wait, there's more, call right now and we'll give you two of them." for the price of one. You know, they started doing recently is, but wait, just call and pay a separate fee and you'll get a second one. I could go to Walmart and buy two things for twice the price. What? How is this a deal? And maybe you should use that as a sales gimmick. Yeah. Buy one more at X number of dollars, buy two at twice the price. Yeah. Don't think, just buy. Right? Or, for fun, you know, buy two for 2.5 times the price and see how many people take it. We did, when I was in the grocery store as a teenager, we did a little experiment. We got a sale on cabbages, or lettuce, heads of lettuce, you know, just iceberg lettuce. And so in one part of the store, we put them 2 for $1, and another part of the store, we put them 49 cents. So, all right, so if you buy 2 of the 49 cents one. Now, in the cash register, people didn't actually pay a different amount, right? It was all worked up in the cash register. They would pay the same price. But the deal was 2 for $1. So we put a bin of them out in another part of the store, said 49 cents a piece. And over in the produce section, we put a bin that said 2 for $1. And guess which one sold out more? 2 for $1. Even though people would be paying 2 cents more for it. They bought more of those ones than they did of the other ones. It was fun. And now you're saying, don't ever buy anything from Pastor. He's a crook. Right? All right. Something spectacular. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven. Oh, I forgot. I was going to say, but wait, there's more. Who else is not going to have to die? The rapture. The church age saints that are alive when Jesus comes to take them back to glory. You'll all be changed in a moment in the twinkling of an eye. Ever seen that verse plastered above a church nursery? We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. Yeah. We have this promise. Paul talks about this mystery, 1 Thessalonians 4. He says, I don't want you to be uninformed, brethren, about those who have fallen asleep. For we, what is it? Because those that have died will not precede, those that are alive will not precede those who have died, but will all be taken up. He tells us about this idea of the rapture, that the resurrection of the righteous is going to happen in a couple of different parts. There's going to be the resurrection of the church age saints at the rapture. So those that have died in the church age, their bodies will be raised from the dead, instantaneously changed into glorified bodies. Those that are alive at that moment, instantaneously changed in the moment, in the twinkling of an eye. And then at the end of the 7-year tribulation, another resurrection of the righteous, where God raises up all the saints of all the ages to inherit the kingdom. And then they'll go into the kingdom with Christ. But Elijah here stands out as something special, something exceptional. Of course, he has his whole life, so it's fitting. The Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind. Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. And Elijah said to Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel. So I want to just take a quick look at our map. Don't be confused, by the way, because there are 2 Gilgals. You have nothing up there. Isn't that... Wow, let me see here. Let's try this. Ha-ha! Thank you, Dan. Okay. There's Gilgal, all right? There are 2 Gilgals throughout the biblical narrative. One of them is down here in the Jordan River Valley. That's the Gilgal that Joshua comes into, and he attacks it early on. But I want you to notice, where is Elijah going? He's going to Bethel. Bethel, we know where this one's at, right here on top of the mountains. And see here. Oh, where'd it go? The path that Elijah is taking here is going to lead him across the Jordan River. So he's not going from Gilgal up to Bethel and then back down to Jericho and across. There is another Gilgal up here in the mountainous regions of Ephraim. And so that's probably the one he's at. And he's making a circuit from Gilgal to Bethel down to Jericho, and then he's going to cross the Jordan River. What he's probably doing here is making a final inspection tour of something that Elijah probably started, which are the schools of the prophets. We've run into these guys a couple of times. They're called the sons of the prophets. And they appear at the same time that Elijah's ministry begins. And it's a little bit of speculation, but it's not too far out there, that Elijah, during some of the quieter years when his ministry is not mentioned as much in the biblical narrative, formed these schools of the prophets around the nation of Israel as an attempt to draw the nation back to covenant faithfulness. Now, he knows he's about to be taken up in this whirlwind, and he's making a final inspection tour of these schools of the prophets. We're going to see the schools of the prophets a little bit more in the ministry of Elisha. Trip over those names all the time. But here, Elijah is going from Gilgal to Bethel. And he's making this tour of these schools. And Elijah said to Elisha, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Bethel." So I don't think he's lying here. I don't think he's making this up. I think the Lord has got him on this mission. He's telling him to wrap things up as he finalizes his ministry on this earth. And so he knows his next step is to go to Bethel and visit with the schools of the prophets there. And he tells Elisha to stay behind. Well, he doesn't tell him. He says, "Please, stay behind." Why would he tell him that? Save him the exhaustion of the trip? Could be. Mm-hmm. What else? Use your sanctified imaginations here. Why would Elijah not want Elisha with him when he's taken up? He doesn't want Elisha to mourn? It could be. Okay, so he's trying to protect him in case this is a violent storm with a tornado. Okay. Right. Gary's saying he thinks it's more of a miraculous happenstance than an actual storm. I think you're right. Eldon? Are you thinking about Job? God answers Job out of the whirlwind? No? It'll come back to you at 2 o'clock this morning. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not sure on that one. But when it comes to you at 2 o'clock in the morning, don't call me. Yeah, write it down. That's right. Write it down. Tell us next week. We're kind of left to speculate. This is one of those areas the Bible didn't record for us why Elijah doesn't want him to come along. It's possible that he's kind of placing a test in front of Elisha to see if he'll actually come along with him, even though there's some opportunity to turn back. But it doesn't say that either. So, though I say, hey, let's use our sanctified imaginations, we have to acknowledge we're using our imaginations, and the evidence from the text just isn't there to give us a real firm decision on why he asks him this. But he does ask him, "Please stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." Now, Elisha has been following Elijah around for quite some time now, ministering with him. And so it's sort of odd that he asks him to stay behind. Because you'd say, now wait a second, why would I back out now? Why would I turn away from this ministry now? Because you anointed me. Don't you remember when Elisha was plowing his field with the 12 yoke of oxen? Elijah came up, dumped the oil on him, and said, you know, you're gonna serve with me. And so Elisha left everything there and started following Elijah. Why would he turn back now? But perhaps it is just one of these last things to say, how serious are you about this ministry and what are you gonna do? Because there's something that Elisha also knows. But we'll get to that. Elisha said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. That's where it was. I was looking for that earlier. Where did they go from Gilgal to Bethel? What direction was it? Down. So from Gilgal to Bethel is down. What does down indicate in the scriptures? Elevation. Not north to south, elevation. So somewhere the Gilgal that he's talking about is higher up in elevation than Bethel. Bethel's way up here at the tops of the mountains, and if we see down there, our handy-dandy little tool tells us we're at about 2,700 feet. This Gilgal is at 735 feet below sea level. So we're at 3,500 feet below it. So he didn't go from this Gilgal up to Bethel. He went from the upper Gilgal down to Bethel. Okay. So they go down to Bethel. Elisha is refusing to part company with him. Verse 3, and the sons of the prophets who were in Bethel. Here's where we start building this idea that Elijah is traveling to these schools of the prophets. One of the sons of the prophets came to Elisha, who were in Bethel, came out to Elisha and said to him, do you know that today the Lord will take away your master from over you? And he said, yes, I know it. Keep quiet. God has revealed to the prophets his plans and intentions for Elijah. Probably he has also revealed those things directly to Elisha. So Elisha knows what's happening here. Why do you suppose Elijah isn't telling them? Elisha says, hey, keep this quiet. Don't say that too loud. Why the hush-hush? Elijah could be afraid. Well, yeah, once again, we're using our imaginations here, so it doesn't tell us why, but put yourself in this position. What might be going on there? Why would Elijah want to keep this quiet? So that nobody follows him? He doesn't want it to be a big public spectacle? Okay, Tim? Oh, so they can't go tell the king. Okay, so he's afraid of someone trying to apprehend Elijah again. That's an interesting thought. I hadn't thought of that one. Okay. All right, once again, there's really no wrong answers there. Of course, that also means there's no right answer because we're not sure. But he says, I know it. Keep quiet. The Lord has revealed this to Elijah. Don't go spreading that around. Verse 4, Elijah said to him, Elisha, please stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho. So now we're moving from Bethel, which is up here in the mountains of Ephraim, and we're going to descend into the Jordan River Valley to the town of Jericho. That's the famous town that Joshua destroyed, placed a curse upon it, was later built. And there's another school of the prophets down here in Jericho that Elijah needs to go visit. And so he says, the Lord has sent me to Jericho. What was that you were saying, Eldon, about the wind blowing the pages around? Having trouble, my Bible keeps wanting to open. That sounds really bad for a pastor to say from the pulpit, doesn't it? Having trouble, my Bible keeps wanting to open. It should be open. It is open. It just keeps wanting to turn to the wrong pages. Go ahead. Elisha swears again, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. Boy, look at the devotion this guy is exhibiting, not only to the mission, but to the man he's been serving for all these years. I'm not going to leave you. I know that you're the one that's on the right path. I know you're walking with God. I know what's going to happen here, but I'm going to do it. How many times has something happened in your life that you wished you knew about ahead of time? And you ask yourself that question, if I knew that was going to happen, would I still have chosen the same path? I don't know what I'd do. You know, some of the stuff that's happened in our life, you say, wow, I look back on it and I see what God's accomplished through it, but boy, they were hard. It was tough stuff. Elijah knows something very difficult's coming. He knows he's going to have to part ways with his master here. He knows Elijah's going to be Elijah is going to be taken to heaven and that he's going to have to continue on without him. But he says, you know, I'm not going to stop this course. I'm not going to change direction. I'm going to continue on this. That takes a great amount of faith. That takes a great amount of devotion. As the Lord lives, as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So they came to Jericho. And once again, the sons of the prophets who were at Jericho drew near to Elisha and said to him, do you know that today the Lord will take away your master from over you? Don't you love how they keep going to Elisha and not to Elijah to ask him what's going on? You know, So you can just imagine that Elijah is probably teaching a class or something, a final seminar, a farewell address to his students at the School of the Prophets, and all the prophets sitting in the back row are whispering to each other, "Psst, psst, psst, Elisha, don't you know the Lord's going to take Elijah from you?" And you say, they should be paying attention. They shouldn't be whispering to each other. But there they are. They're passing along these messages. Once again, Elisha answers, "Yes, I know it. Keep quiet. Keep that to yourself. That's not something we need to publish abroad for whatever reason." Verse 6, "Then Elijah said to him, 'Please stay here, for as the Lord has sent me to the Jordan.'" So here's the next step in our journey. We're going to keep descending the Jordan River Valley. We're going to go from Jericho, and we're going to make the trek over to the Jordan River. That's where I'm heading. It's a little bit of a long trek. It's going to be a tough one. I want you to stay here. But Elisha once again says the same thing. "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." Does this remind you of anybody else in Scripture? Peter? Which part? Where at in Peter? Oh, he does, but then does he do it? No. He runs away. Mm-hmm. Ruth. Yeah, that's reminded me of Ruth too, because Naomi says, "Hey, why don't you stay here, go back to your own kindred, and find another hubby, settle down, start your new life." And her answer is much the same as what Elisha says here. "Your God will be my God, your people will be my people. I'm renouncing everything that was behind me, and I'm going ahead." It's a great picture of the Christian life. Because what did even Jesus tell us? That you can't put your hand to the plow and turn around and look behind you and wonder what might have been. You know, think about all the different ways God has led your life. Think about all the different paths He's taken you on. And so when you ask yourself, would I trade that for something different? Ooh, I hope your answer is no. I mean, that doesn't mean that I haven't made some really bonehead mistakes in my life that I wish I hadn't made and I'd like to go back and correct. But hasn't God even used those things in our lives to teach us and to train us? And so if I'd say, yeah, if I hadn't made those mistakes, it'd be because I already knew what I was supposed to know. But I didn't know it, and He used those circumstances to teach me what I needed to know. And that I wouldn't trade for anything. Well, Elisha is demonstrating this principle of our spiritual walk, that you can't look back. You can't turn around and say, wow, Egypt looked really good, didn't it? What happens to people that turn around and wish for the leeks and onions and garlic that were in Egypt? Well, that's a different part of the story. Yeah, Lot's wife turned into a pillar of salt because she wanted to look back and wish for all the things she was leaving behind. God brought how many disciplines upon the people of Israel wandering through the wilderness because they kept saying, oh, you know, the leeks, the onions, the garlic, we love that place, the spices, the savory food. Must have been a stinky breath place to live in Egypt. You say, people, you were slaves! You were under severe burdens in Egypt. You really want to go back to that? So here, when you start thinking about, boy, would I choose this life for myself that God's led me on? Start thinking about what your life was like before Christ. I know some of us, you got saved earlier in life. It's a little harder to see because God gave you that mercy that you were raised in a Christian home. And life was not too terrible before you came to Christ. You still recognized your sin. Not trying to say at all that people that get saved young don't recognize their sin, because they do. I know they do. And the grace that saves somebody raised in a Christian home is the same grace that's exercised towards those that weren't. But think about what your life could have been. All the snares and traps, all of the enslavement that sin could have brought. You know what you were like. Even if you got saved at 5 years old, you can look back and say, I know where I was headed. Life dominated by sin is horrible. If you don't know that, just go talk to some people that don't know Christ. See what their life is like. It'll stir your heart with compassion for them, hopefully. Well, Elisha is refusing to take a different path. I'm going with you. As the Lord lives, as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So the two of them went on. Well, now they're not the only two, because verse 7, 50 men of the sons of the prophets also went and stood at some distance from them as they both were standing by the Jordan. So I would love to be in this group of people and wonder why it is they're not walking with Elijah and Elisha. They're walking behind them. They're at a distance like they're afraid to approach these two guys. and say, what's going on there? They apparently recognize that something of great importance is about to happen, and they want to see it, but they're afraid to be too close to it. They're terrified of what's going to happen, but they want to see it. It's kind of like a tornado. You know, you kind of want to see one, but off there in the distance where it's not hurting anybody. Hannah says, I'll be in the basement. Thank you very much. Right? Kind of like snakes and spiders. I don't mind looking at them from a reasonable distance. As long as they're not getting too close, they're fine. They're so cute. Snakes and spiders? Oh, I see where you're going. Okay. Well, these 50 men, they're standing at a distance. Verse 8, then Elijah, here's part of the spectacular. This is where things start getting extraordinary. Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck it on the water, and the water was parted to the one side and to the other till the two of them could go over on dry ground. Who does this remind you of? The Israelites crossing the Jordan. Right. This is a repetition of that miracle with Joshua and the Israelites and crossing the Jordan, even Moses parting the Red Sea. It's happening all over again. What is the point of this? Why does God perform this miracle? Nothing God does is without purpose. Remember that. Why do you think God is doing this? To show people he's still in control? Which people? The Israelites? But they're not even there to see it. Who's there to see it? Okay, the sons of the prophets are there from a distance. Who else sees it? Elisha. Here's what I think God's doing. Elijah's ministry has been dramatic and powerful in the life of Israel. It hasn't produced quite the revival that Elijah hoped it would. I just lost my map up there. But it has produced results. It has accomplished something in drawing some of the people of Israel back to faithfulness to Jehovah, because there weren't any schools of the prophets before Elijah came along. So Elijah runs off to Mount Sinai, laments, I'm the only one left, and God says, no, you're not the only one. There's 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to Baal. So he gets that encouragement, and then he's given a mission. Go anoint Elijah as your successor, go anoint Jehu, the king of Israel, and go anoint Hazael, the king of Syria. How many of those things have been accomplished so far? Which one? Elisha's been anointed. What about Jehu and Hazael? We haven't even encountered them in the narrative yet. There's still work to be done. So who's going to do it? Elisha. So what do you think Elisha might need to know if he's going to accomplish this great work that this great man, Elijah, started? That God is still there. Here's our lesson. God parts the waters of the Jordan. I don't think for Elijah, but I think he does it for Elisha, because it's going to happen again in just a little bit. All right? So we're going to keep going. They pass over on dry ground. What an amazing thing. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, ask what I shall do for you before I am taken from you. This is the first acknowledgement Elijah has given that he's going to be disappearing. But he says, Elisha, what do you want? Why have you been following me all this time? What is it you're after? So, what would you ask? Give me long life so I can accomplish a bunch of things, right? Hey, give me a lot of money. That way I can, you know, have a big ministry and see lots of people ministered to. Big building? I don't know. You know, the schools of the prophets, they're kind of small and run down. They need some help. What would you ask for? What does Elisha ask for? Please let there be a double portion of your spirit on me. What does that question mean? I want twice as much power as you, Elijah? I want to be able to do twice the amazing things you do? Tim? So he wants to be twice as godly and twice as powerful. Okay? What'd you say, Gene? He wants more faith? Okay, I want to trust God twice as much as you do. All right. What's the idea of the double portion? So he wants Elijah's spirit to be with him. So God's spirit and Elijah's? Okay. Who gets a double portion in Scripture? The firstborn. Why? What is he? He's the heir. He's the successor. He's the one that takes charge of the family when Papa's gone, right? So the firstborn gets the inheritance, and the symbol of that is the double portion. Remember when Joseph sat all his brothers down and he lined them up according to age, and he gave the oldest the double portion, even though he wasn't supposed to know who they were. Elisha is asking to be the successor. He's asking to inherit the same power that Elijah has, because Elisha knows where this power is coming from. It's not from Elijah and his fiery spirit. It's from the Spirit of God. And so Elisha is saying, I want to minister in the same power that you do. I want to have the same faith in God that you do. I want to have the same God working through me that you do, because I need to continue on. I know that I'm going to be the one to continue on the work that you started. It's not done yet. And so he asks for a fantastic thing. And verse 10, Elisha acknowledges that. You have asked a hard thing. Yet if you see me as I am being taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if you do not see me, it shall not be so. Why does Elisha have to see him? So he knows what's going to happen? Okay. I'll just say again, this is one of those passages that leaves a lot unexplained. We sure would like to, like, peer behind it and figure out what's going on in the background. Why does he have to see him? What is that all about? But you know what? There are just some things God chose not to tell us. But we know that's the condition. Elisha, you've got to stay with me until the very end. And if you see it happen, that means you stuck around. It means you were paying attention. It means you were with me. You were fulfilling what you were supposed to do up till that moment. Then that's what's going to happen. You will be the successor. You'll inherit the same spirit that I have. You'll get that double portion you're looking for. So, verse 11, as they still went on and talked. Oh, wouldn't you like to be a fly on the wall for those conversations? What would Elijah be passing on to his successor in his last moments? Anybody, somebody close to you pass away and you have their last words? All of my relatives that have passed away thus far have been heavily sedated. And there was no passing of last wisdom. Something we miss out on a little bit. But wouldn't you like to know what Elijah's telling Elisha here? What kind of teaching is going on? The amazing stuff to hear. So as they went on, they talked, behold. And what does the word behold mean? Pay attention. Something weird is about to happen. And here's what's weird. Behold, chariots of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. So all of a sudden, here's why I'm with Gary, and I think this is not a normal storm. Because it happens that fast. This whirlwind comes down and these chariots of fire swoop by. They push the two men apart from each other. They grab Elisha and he's suddenly gone. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, kind of that same way, right? But he's gone. He's taken up to heaven and Elisha is just standing there holding this mantle that fell down. Elisha saw it and he cried, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And he saw him no more. It's kind of a sad statement there. It's what we experience every time we're parted from somebody that we love when they have to leave this earth. When does Elijah appear next? Say it again. The Mount of Transfiguration is the next time we see him, right? He's standing there with Christ and with Moses. And Peter makes that fun statement. He says, hey, Lord, it's good for us to be here. Let us build three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. Why does he say that? He's putting all three of them on the same level, right? And what's God's answer? This is my beloved son. You listen to him. As great a man as Elijah was, he's not your Savior and Lord. As great a man as Moses was, he's not your Savior and your Lord. My son is. You listen to him. my father, the chariots of Israel and his horsemen. Then he took hold of his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. And he took up the cloak of Elijah that had fallen from him. And he went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. And he took the cloak of Elijah that had fallen from him. And he struck the water saying, where is the Lord, the God of Elijah? Now, that's not the doubting, challenging statement that it seems to come across. He is calling upon God to act through him the same way that God acted through Elijah. So it's not like, where is God? Well, is God going to do this? I'm challenging you, Lord. I'm daring you. That's not it at all. We're constantly forbidden in Scripture to put God to the test like that. So Elijah's not daring God. He's not challenging him, but he wants to see him visibly display that what Elijah said was true. I saw him go up. I saw the chariots take him. He told me that I would then have a double portion of his spirit. So has it happened? And he smacks the water with that cloak, and what happens? Water parts. And he's able to walk over. The same miracle that Elijah just performed a little while earlier, Elisha is able to perform, and it confirms for him, yes, you are God's next man. You're the guy God's chosen to continue that work. You're the guy that God is now going to work through to minister to his people, Israel. And so he struck the water. The water was parted to one side and to the other, and Elisha went over. Chariots of fire. God's mighty display of power. God's purposes in all this, some of it he doesn't tell us. We know that Elijah was taken up to heaven for a very spectacular purpose. A couple of the prophets reference that one day Elijah would have come back, and he did. But it wasn't him. But he came in the spirit and power of Elijah. And who was that? John the Baptist. So he appears on the scene the same way Elijah did. He departs a little differently, because John the Baptist had to be beheaded to finish his course. Folks, I don't know what course God has you on. I don't know the paths he's going to lead you upon. But I know the same God that led Elijah to heaven in chariots of fire, the same God that took Moses off to die quietly in the solitude of Mount Pisgah, the same God that led John the Baptist to be beheaded, the same God that allowed Peter to be crucified upside down, is the same God that leads us. He supplies the same power and strength to accomplish whatever task he has given us, because he will not be faithless to his own promise. I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. We might not be able to throw our coat at a stream of water and have it part to the sides. That might not be God's purposes through you. But what is he trying to accomplish in you and through you throughout the days of your life? Elijah finished his course, and he finished it well. Are we going to be able to say the same? Any questions?